Welcome back to the Lars Resort. Still a podcast with me, Lars Everton, brought to you by Betson. We have returned from a kind of Easter, an extended Easter break, let's call it that way. You know, I went to the other side of the world and recorded a kind of Texan trilogy with Peter, and then sort of zoomed around that country a bit, and now we're back, and so many things have happened, of course. I feel like there's too much to choose from in terms of stuff to do a pod about. But really, it's interesting, last episode we did was with Peter, and that was the sort of giddy United had played Liverpool in the Cup. It had been a wild and wonderful game that didn't make a lot of sense in a lot of ways. So we had to record a pod, and so I'm sat here now, and I feel like not much has changed, really. United have played Liverpool in a wild and wonderful game that I feel like we do need to talk about. Though, of course, you can go back and listen to the last episode, and a lot of the talking points from that one are still valid. It is the sort of mysterious Erik ten Hag donut of doom approach to things that Man United are doing that doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. But in a way it worked. You know, they got a result, implausible though it may have been, and it does seem as if you want to be slightly tabloidy about it, Liverpool's title bid was undone by the donut of doom, which is, I mean, it just felt so unlikely watching the game. How Liverpool only scored two goals in that game, I don't know. How they didn't get a result, I don't know. I really enjoyed Jurgen Klopp's reaction, because he was asked by the reporter, BBC's reporter from Match of the Day. The opening question was sort of, oh, there seems to be some disappointment for both teams with the result from that. And Jurgen Klopp did like a huge double take. Like, what, United are disappointed? but then moved on, because he realised that's dangerous territory to go down. But yeah, very, very weird that United got anything from it. And I feel like we don't need to rehash the whole bizarro formation thing that United are doing. Inevitably, I will probably end up talking about it, because it's hard not to talk about it, because this is one of the most weird things that are happening in world football at the moment. And the criticisms that we made in the last episode are all valid. Like, I've looked at some numbers now. Only Sheffield United are averaging more shots against per game than Manchester United in the Premier League season. I mean, this is absurd. After the Everton game, Erik ten Hag famously said that he wasn't worried because they were only low-value shots, and they were mostly in that game, to be fair to him, but overall, that has not been the case. Only West Ham, Sheffield United, and Luton have conceded a higher XG number overall this season than Manchester United. This is sort of relegation form defensively. That's just absolutely wild stuff. In the last couple of games, or the last few games, the number of shots United have had against them is, what, 28, 28, and 31? Like, it's just like you're closing in on 100 shots against in three games. This is not good. Now, in fairness to United, you could argue that injuries have been a bit of a factor here. Aside from the sort of tactical absurdities, Erik ten Hag has had to field a full 27 different back four combinations this season. That is obviously not ideal. I thought the young man, Kambuala, actually had some good moments in this game. But it is, for me, the hole in midfield formation, the donut of doom, is the main culprit here. And I don't think you can argue that it's working. United have gotten some results. I feel like they're mostly just getting away with it. But then some might say, is it working on some level? Because they have now gotten a result against Liverpool in two games in pretty short space of time, which is not something every team manages to do. And if we're trying to look at what might be working with this approach, I mean, they are getting a good number of so-called high turnovers, like winning the ball back high up the field. I don't know, I don't have access to updated numbers on that, but about a month ago they were sixth in the league for high turnovers, which scans, you know, that's something that they are better at than other teams around. And it just looks like, I guess, Erik ten Hag wants these high turnovers on the one hand. He wants to press high, but he has maybe accepted that he doesn't or can't play with a high line, with the defenders he has. seems like that's just kind of something he's accepted, and that we're just going to have this massive gap in midfield because the defender, the attackers go to press, the defenders stay back. There's loads of space that nobody seems to want to fill in. Maybe that's something you could get away with consistently if you had like Peak and N'Golo Kante running around in there, just gobbling up everything. But of course, what you do have is Casemiro, who's 32 now and moving like he's a couple of years older than that. Two more years on that contract, huh? That's, if you look at Casemiro's physical capacity now, his ability to cover ground in midfield, you've got two more seasons of this. It's not great. I wonder if Sir Jim Radcliffe and the lads will be sort of praying to the oil gods that the Saudis decide to take Casemiro off their hands. Because I think that's the only way you're getting him off the books. You know, that contract he's on, no one else is offering him that. So maybe he wants to take a massive wage cut right towards the end of his career. Players tend not to want that. So it might have to be a Saudi solution if you want to de-Casemiro your midfield. But it is a weird setup, and I can't think of any other team that plays like this. Could it work long term? It's very hard to imagine, but I just think Erik ten Hag is mostly trying to get to the next game. I don't think he's thinking long term at all, and I don't think he has a long term. I think the chances of the new management team, let's call it that, I mean new owners feels like a weird thing to say because of course the new guys only own 25%, but I think the chances of them keeping Erik ten Hag over the summer are very, very, very small. I don't really see that happening. What Erik ten Hag is right about, because he is saying increasingly weird things after games. He's in that sort of phase of a managerial stint where what he says about games after the games just is very hard to... it seems like he's watching different games than the rest of us sometimes. But what he is right about, and what should be a big takeaway from this season if you're a United fan, is that there is a lot of potential in this team. The big positives to come out of this season is that you have some really exciting young players who are starting to make names for themselves, and with maybe a different boss and a different sort of project, yucky word, different project going forward. There is interesting stuff there to look forward to. Anyway, we are burying the lead here a little bit. As fun and funny as United are at the moment, and I would argue that they're currently the most watchable team in the Premier League because their games are just unhinged. The big story here this weekend is that this slip, this is a slip from Liverpool. This is Liverpool dropping 2 points in the title race. They were favourites to win the league with the bookmakers before the weekend. They are no longer the favourites. So the sort of odds compilers in the market has certainly had a big shift there. And I mean, on that note, big shout out to John Cross from the Daily Mirror, who for what must have been the tweet of the weekend, because of course in this sort of title race you get headlines along the lines of, well, supercomputer from this and that company says there's a certain percentage chance of this and that happening. This is par for the course. Anyway, John Cross tweeted, if a supercomputer keeps changing its percentages on the chances of each of the three teams winning the title, then it can't be that super after all. Says John Cross. And I just like, this is a fabulous tweet. Yes, it is true. The estimated percentage chance of something happening will change as events unfold. Like these supercomputers, like these models, they're not oracles, they're not Ouija boards. These models, they try to work out the probabilities based on available data. Now, when you have new data to base the projections on, the projections will tend to change. You know, that's just kind of how probabilities work. Amazing stuff. Love that. Anyway, congratulations to him. Anyway, the estimated chances of Liverpool winning the league have gone down by quite a bit after this game. Was this them fumbling the title? Can we be slightly tabloidy and say Erik ten Hag's donut ball has ended Jurgen Klopp's dream of one more Premier League title with Liverpool? Well, he clearly hasn't ended it. The dream is still alive. But the dream has been dealt a pretty severe blow. That is fair to say, I think. And the frustrating thing, of course, is that Liverpool were the best team by some distance. They created a bunch of chances. They just missed them. And I honestly find that's almost a harder thing to try to say anything worthwhile about. Because if a team is playing badly, and the team is unable to do what it's trying to do, or it's hard to work out what it is that they're trying to do, or the thing that they're trying to do doesn't make sense, we can look at it and discuss it, and think of reasons why, and what can be fixed, and whatever. The Liverpool team is kind of working. It's, you know, you go away to Old Trafford and you have 28 shots. I don't love single game XG as a metric, but I'm sure the XG was very high in this case, if that matters. And in layman's terms, yeah, they created so many chances. And beyond the actual chances they created, there were so many situations where they were in transitional moments where there's just space everywhere, and so many openings and so many things you can do. It's, again, like the cup game, at times it reminded me of that sort of mad Tottenham-Chelsea game from the autumn where there was just space everywhere. Now, of course, there was space everywhere because Tottenham had two red cards. In this case, there was space everywhere because United have made this sort of executive decision to just not have a midfield. Very strange behaviour. But then, of course, Liverpool, they wasted so many of those opportunities. Like, slightly overhit passes, wrong decision at the wrong time. They just couldn't get the goals. And it feels like this has happened before to Liverpool this season, because we know it's happened before to Liverpool this season. If you look at other games where they've dropped points, well, the other game against United, but even like the other time they drew against City, they had 19 shots to City's 10. So they were well on top of that one. They've had a couple of, okay, they were well beaten by Arsenal at the Etihad. The 1-1 draw against Arsenal at Anfield was pretty even in terms of chances. And when they lost to City at the Etihad, then City were the better team. Okay, they have been soundly beaten in a few games. But the other United game was also completely ridiculous. I mean, that ended 0-0, but it was 34-6 in shots. Like, it was a ridiculous game. They dropped points against Luton. Liverpool had 28 shots to Luton's 8 in that one. So in these sort of two nonsensical games against United, plus the Luton game, that's really cost. I mean, that's 6 points gone from games that where you look at what happened. It really should have been 9. Arsenal clearly has had Liverpool's number this season, or certainly been able to control them. They've had one good and one bad game against City. They lost that insane game against Tottenham where some of the refereeing calls went against them. But over those two United games and the Luton game, again, you've had 3 points off a total of 94 shots. Like, if you have 94 shots in 3 games, typically you will get more than 3 points out of those 3 games. But Liverpool, wasting chances there. And so far, they have been the best attack in the league in terms of XG generated. But I don't think it's unfair to suggest that they have then lacked a little bit of composure in these key moments. I think these are the games, if they don't go on to win the league, they will look back at and think, how on earth did we manage to stuff that up? And the obvious lightning rod for criticism then will be Darwin Nunez. I think that's pretty inevitable. He has scored 11 goals. He's got 11 goals and 8 assists this season, which is not terrible. And actually, if you look at if you look at non-penalty goals and assists per 90, so adjusted for playing time, he's actually second in the league by that metric, behind Diogo Jota, who's been very, very efficient when he's been on the field. Ollie Watkins in third, Mo Salah in fourth. So I suppose it says something about the Liverpool attack that you've got 3 Liverpool players in the top 4 there. Should we do the whole top 10, actually? This is kind of interesting. It's Nunez, Jota and Watkins as the top 3, Mohamed Salah, and then Chris Wood in fifth for non-penalty goals plus assists per 90. Yeah, because when it is adjusted for game time, you know, Wood has been pretty effective when he's played recently. Erling Haaland is sixth. Son Heung-min is seventh. Leon Bailey is an eighth. A joint eight with the pigeon commander himself, Richarlison, and Taiwo Awoniyi, who, of course, we love on this podcast, sneaking into the top 10. Now, with Nunez, I feel like we've gone almost full circle here, because he arrived with a big transfer fee, big expectation, all this sort of stuff, had a poor first season, was written off by a lot of people, unfairly, I think, to write him off entirely. But of course, it wasn't a huge success last season, you have to say. But he has then gradually become a kind of a cult figure to a lot of people, and a lot of Liverpool fans in particular, because of his work rate, because of his attitude, the way he approached things. And he does actually do a lot of things on the field. And I also think fans, Liverpool fans, but really all football fans, kind of become a little bit defensive about players who are on their team, who they can see week to week. If you go every week, you see Darwin Nunez do a lot of good things. Whereas if you're a pundit and you watch a few headlines, if you watch a few highlights here and there, and you only watch him miss chances on Match of the Day, you might be a bit harsher on him. So I guess fans can be a little bit defensive of a character like that, and that's completely understandable. But I do wonder if the danger of turning someone into a cult figure is that you can end up being blinded to the fact that he does have some weaknesses. And unfortunately, there is another stat where Darwin shows up pretty well, and that is non-penalty goals minus non-penalty XG. If you take the goals you've scored, subtract the XG value of all your shots, and then you have a number that's either a positive or a negative, and is a pretty good indicator as to whether or not you've been efficient with your chances. Son Heung-min has the best number in the league here. He tends to do well, tends to be near the top of that or right at the top, because he's a very good striker of the ball. He often scores from range and from difficult positions, sort of low quality chances. So we're used to seeing him near the top there. Jared Bowen's actually second. That's kind of interesting. No, these numbers are all from the FBRF website, as usual, by the way. Phil Foden is third, very efficient with his shooting this season, but of course he's also someone who strikes the ball very well. Diogo Jota's fourth, very efficient. Chris Wood, it's fifth. So doing well in this category, it tends to mean either that you're an unusually good finisher, that you're very efficient with your finishes, or it can mean that you've been a bit lucky and that you're on a bit of a hot streak and that this will probably even itself out. Looking at you, Chris Wood. But let's flip the chair. Let's see the other side of it. I remember we did this a while back ago when we were talking about Everton. Now, some more games have been played since then, but let me click the button here, and yes, there he is, Dominic Calvert-Lewin, still the worst number in the league for this in terms of wasting chances, even though of course he did get on the score sheet, the opposition goalkeeper passing the ball to him, that was nice, that was helpful, but he is still the most wasteful striker in the league according to the XG, followed by Nicholas Jackson, that scans, followed by Julian Alvarez, that's a bit of a surprise, and then in fourth, Darwin Nunez. So he is, yeah, as much as he has been contributing, he has also clearly been missing chances. Brennan Johnson, number five on that list. Also someone who's missed some chances, Spurs fans will know. And perhaps surprisingly, though, I guess if you're enough of a nerd to listen to this pod, you're probably well across this, Erling Haaland is sixth. As we know, he's having a bit of an iffy season in front of goal by his standards. But Darwin Nunez, very much in the red on this metric. The FBRF website has numbers on him for the last five seasons, and he has been well in the red on this metric in all of them, except for one. And that was the season he played for Benfica before Liverpool bought him. So it does rather suggest that he is a guy who is an unreliable finisher, who had one brilliant season and got his big move off the back of that season, and is now back to being an unreliable finisher. Seems to be the case. Now, you guys know that I occasionally become obsessed with players who are getting a lot of criticism, and I become convinced that people are wrong about them and they're actually better. Kai Havertz, most notably, and that seems to be proving some people wrong. Kai, isn't he just the Balak Berbatov hybrid? Kai Havertz is starting anyway. I'm not going to go that far with Darwin. I don't necessarily think he's a misunderstood genius. I think he's probably just a striker who does a lot of good things for the team, but isn't as composed in front of goal as you would want a striker at that level to be. Can this be taught? Can it be improved? Possibly. But what I would always say about Darwin at Liverpool, to add some nuance to here, is that you shouldn't forget the other stuff he brings to the table. You can look at these numbers and say, hey, look, if Liverpool had a better finisher instead of Darwin, they would have scored more goals and had a better chance of winning the league. That looks obvious on the surface of things. But what you then have to remember is, you subtract Darwin from the lineup and replace him with a hypothetical striker who's more clinical, would that striker also have Darwin's work rate off the ball? Would he track back and close down opponents as much as Darwin does? Would he be the sort of agent of chaos that Darwin Nunez is, and the way he kind of makes things happen? Because as much as he misses chances, he also creates a lot of them just by hard work and endeavor. So the equation isn't as simple as replace striker who misses with striker who scores. You're then also swapping all the other things that player does, and will the new guy do all those things is the question. And finding a striker with his work rate, his sort of physical presence, who's also an elite finisher, they're not that easy. They don't grow on trees. And with Liverpool, one of the most aggressive, sort of high-pressing teams, even though Mo Salah plays every game pretty much, and he doesn't have the defensive output that he used to have anymore and can't run as much off the ball as he used to, you really do need the other two in the front three to work very, very hard, and the central one in particular to help out on that side. And Darwin may underperform his XG, but looking at his number, he also wins more tackles than 82% of the other strikers in the top five leagues. So he's an aggressive tackler up there. His non-penalty XG plus expected assists per 90 is in the top 1%. So, like, in terms of his overall attacking output and what he does for the team, it's very, very good. He just lacks a little bit. The man has no chill in front of goals, and that is a problem. Now, I won't go along with the idea that he's just useless. I'm not having it, but he is a little bit less clinical, and that maybe costs Liverpool in some types of situations. Perhaps that is true. But having said that, I mean, the worst miss was probably Mo Salah's miss in the United game, right? So, I mean, it can happen to anyone. Anyway, this has been the story of Liverpool's season. In comparison to Arsenal and Manchester City, Liverpool have the most productive attack in the league in terms of XG generated. They've just been a little bit unreliable defensively. They do concede goals and concede some bad goals. And again, in these sort of games, against United, weirdly, in particular, they've just lacked a little bit of the composure. I mean, one of the things we've had success with on the betting column this season is backing Liverpool to win and both teams to score. I mean, very annoyingly, didn't land this weekend, but that's been a pretty consistent winner for us over there this season, because they're so good going forward, but they just always give the other team a chance. But having said, I do again feel, if you're a Liverpool fan, and you might be screaming at the podcast player of your choice right now, it feels remiss not to mention, when we talk about Liverpool being a little bit fragile defensively, they have been playing these sort of crucial season defining games with a couple of pretty inexperienced youngsters in defense, and with their reserve goalkeeper in goal. Now, Kelleher has done really well. Bradley's been phenomenal at right wing back or right back. And Kwanzaa has been doing a pretty good job, but unfortunately, that mistake for the United goal, amazing finish from Bruno Fernandes, of course, but really, really bad mistake, and that just kind of feels like a mistake that a more experienced player doesn't make. You know, away to Manchester United at Old Trafford, you just kind of play a blind square ball across your own defence. It's just, you don't, yeah, it's not something I think a more experienced player is likely to have done. So those sort of injury absences, they just end up costing you, however well the replacements do. And we can analyse and overanalyse tactics and stats and the psychology and all this sort of stuff, but injuries, which feels like the least interesting thing in the world to talk about, it has such a huge impact on these outcomes, on these title races. Honestly, I think injuries is probably the thing in football that has the biggest impact compared to how little we talk about it, if that makes sense. If you create some kind of impact to discourse ratio, then I think injuries is probably at the far end of one. And maybe it's a good thing that we don't talk about injuries too much, because I think very, very few people in the media, certainly myself included, are actually like qualified to have any opinions on the medical stuff. Like, are certain teams getting more injuries because of the way they play and how they train? I don't know. Like, I don't know enough about it, and we also don't know anything about how they train, how they manage the physical load behind the scenes, what kind of recovery stuff they do, what kind of stretching they do. Like, all this, I have no idea. We don't know. So any discussion of that just becomes fully hypothetical. But the injuries, they play such a huge part. Anyway, I find myself talking about this in a manner which suggests it's completely over. Like, this has started feeling like a Liverpool sort of post-mortem, but of course they're not dead. The title challenge is still very much alive, and let's look at it, because we're now really coming into the run-in here. You know, we're starting on the quarterfinals of the Champions League this week. All the three teams in the Premier League, they have the same number of games left, let's look at the run-in, huh? I think this is good. Who's playing whom and what's happening? Arsenal, as you'll know, are currently top with 71 points and a goal difference of plus 51. Liverpool are second with 71 points, same number of points, slightly worse goal difference, plus 42. And Manchester City are third with 70 points, 1 point behind, goal difference of plus 40. So the goal difference is pretty close between City and Liverpool, but Arsenal, because their excellent defensive record, are a little bit ahead there. Now, first of all, what a battle this is going to be. Every team having seven games left and then being that close. Really exciting, great thing to see that it doesn't look like we're going to have a coronation at the top of the league. So let's look at Arsenal again, top of the league. They're playing Aston Villa at home. They're playing Wolves away. They're playing Chelsea at home, Tottenham away, Bournemouth at home, then United away, and then Everton at home. Now, Arsenal have a big thing going for them. Well, going into this period, They've won 10 out of the last 11. They've conceded just 2 goals in their last 8. Like, clearly they've really hit some good form. They look very, very solid. They look confident. They're top to start out with. It's pretty helpful. The negative thing, I'd say, is the fixture list. I mean, Arsenal haven't been amazing away against teams from the top half of the table. Away from home against the teams that are currently 9th and above, Arsenal have actually just won 1 in 6 this season. They beat West Ham, but they drew away to Chelsea, away to Liverpool and away to City. They lost away to Villa and Newcastle. I know that was at a very different point in the season, of course, when the team wasn't playing as well as they are now, but I think it's still worth noting that they haven't been perfect away from home against these stronger opponents. The Champions League is a factor here. I mean, I'm expecting them to knock out Bayern. Bayern looking all out of sorts at the moment, losing to Heidenheim at the weekend. And in the semi-final, likely to come up against City. I mean, you'd make City favourites against Real Madrid. That's a tighter game, probably, but you'd make them favourite. So it's very possible that we'll have a Arsenal City semi-final in the middle of this title race, which will take place then in the week between the game against Tottenham and the game against Bournemouth, and then on the other side of the Bournemouth game, between that and the United game, they'll be playing a semi-final if they get there, which I think they will. So the way this works out, on the 23rd of April they play Chelsea, 5 days later they play Spurs away, then they play a hypothetical first semi-final possibly against City, then there's the Bournemouth game, then there's the City return leg, and then they go away to this bizarro donut-powered Manchester United team. That is a heck of a 2-week run for Arsenal and for Arsenal fans. That's going to be an emotional time. I hope you guys have, I don't know, booked some time off work, stocked up on Valium. I mean, what a time to be. I mean, this is what you want as a football fan, to experience your team being involved in these things. But wow, nerve-wracking. And of course, that's when you get into stuff like a hamstring injury to the wrong player, or a red card and a ban or something, like little things like that that can happen almost randomly, can completely derail your season. The Bournemouth game kind of looks like a bit of a trap here. That'll be the one where you maybe, you know, relax a little bit. But A, I'm not sure Bournemouth are good enough to be an effective trap. They're not great, and they're also on the beach. And B, I'm just... Arsenal this season, they don't really look like a team that would mess things like that up anymore. There's been a sort of solidity and a maturity to them that's been very impressive. They have 2 London derbies in quick succession. A year ago, I would have said that I don't trust their sort of maturity in those situations. But they've looked, a much more grown-up team this season. I think the heart and the brain very well and truly holding hands now, as Arteta might put it. I have a creeping suspicion still that Arsenal might drop points somewhere. And I think it's the Chelsea, United and Spurs games. They're all big X factors for me, because all 3 of those teams are capable of playing well, but are also capable of playing ridiculously. And I just think out of 3 games, there's a chance that the opponent will turn up in at least one, right? United's ridiculous as they have been, as they continue to be, they have now stopped Liverpool twice in quick succession. Chelsea have played 5 games against the top 3 this season, actually just lost once. They lost away to Liverpool, but they drew at home to Arsenal, at home to City, and at home to Liverpool, and away to City. You know, as bad as Chelsea have been, they've been awkward in these games. As for Spurs, the unlikely kingmakers here, they beat Liverpool at home, very lucky. Some weird stuff happened in that game, of course, but they got a draw away to City, they got a draw away to Arsenal. They haven't lost against the top 3 this season either, and just from 3 games, it's a small sample size, but still. Now, watching how Tottenham defend at times, it's very hard to understand how that's happened, but it has happened. So, out of those 3 games, I absolutely don't think Arsenal will not win any of them. That'd be crazy. But they're coming up against opponents that are incredibly inconsistent, unreliable. You don't know what you're going to get from them. But I do wonder you'd think one of them would turn up. Maybe not all 3 or 2, but in one of those games, the opponents is going to be on it. And I'm not fully convinced Arsenal will win all 3, is what I'm saying. I don't think Arsenal will win every game between now and the end of the season. Which does leave us with their challengers. First off, Liverpool. They have got Palace at home, Fulham away, Everton away, West Ham away, Spurs at home, Villa away, and Wolves at home. You'd say that is a better fixture list. their injury situation with the starting goalkeeper and the right back being injured is not a positive, obviously. Matip being injured and Konate being unreliable, I guess, in his availability. He's not, you can't always use him, which means you do risk going into these pivotal games with just 2/5 of your first choice defensive unit. No matter how well the backups are doing, that just isn't a good thing for the team. I think another thing that counts against Liverpool a little bit is that they're still in the Europa League. They have to play on Thursdays. That is a slight sort of disadvantage. Players seem to dislike playing Thursday, Sunday more than they dislike playing Tuesday or Wednesday and then onto Saturday for some reason. So I think that is a slight disadvantage for them. One advantage they have, like everyone else, they play Spurs, but they play Spurs immediately after Spurs are played against Arsenal and Chelsea. All right, the way this works out, Tottenham, they play Arsenal on the 28th of April, they play Chelsea on the 2nd of May, and then Liverpool just 3 days after that. Now, knowing how feisty those London derbies tend to get, I think there's a pretty good chance that Tottenham pick up a suspension or two during those games, or at least that they come out of it pretty drained emotionally. So I think being the last team here, or facing Tottenham after they've played those two games in quick succession, I think that is a slight advantage for Liverpool. That said, over 7 games played this season in the league against Arsenal, City, Tottenham and United, Liverpool have yet to win. No wins from 7 games against those opponents. They go away to Aston Villa, who are not quite as good as they were before Christmas, but they're good at home, so that's a bit of a tricky one. And I just kind of find it a little bit hard to trust Liverpool because of the injuries, because they always give up chances during games. There's a part of me that kind of hopes they win it because they've been so fun to watch. I think as a neutral, all else being equal and regardless of the opponent, you'd probably rather watch Liverpool than Arsenal or City. They're just kind of more fun. And Jurgen Klopp, I think, has been, broadly speaking, a very positive force in the Premier League. I mean, his behaviour, he has a dark side, like all very competitive men, but I think as a guy and the football he's brought has been very positive, and it would be nice to see him win the title before he left. But I can't quite shake the feeling that there's some kind of accident or collapse or disaster lurking for Liverpool here. Maybe that's just recency bias because I saw them miss so many chances and kind of lose their composure a little bit against United. This is mostly irrational gut feeling stuff for me, but I do think Liverpool will drop points as well at some point. Which brings us to Manchester City, who are 3rd, 1 point behind the other two, and they're playing Luton at home. They're playing Tottenham at some point. This one has to be moved because City are in the FA Cup. We don't know when that game is being played. It'll be played at some point, but it's Luton at home, Brighton away, Forest away, Wolves at home, Fulham away, and West Ham at home. I think they win all of those games. I honestly, City, they got draws against Arsenal and Liverpool, and they had that weird game against Chelsea where they had 31 shots and in a manner akin to Liverpool, couldn't convert. But aside for that, they've won every game they've played since mid-December. And that's without the team really fully clicking, right? Now, we saw last week against Aston Villa, they actually played some of the best football we've seen from them in a while now in terms of how the game flowed. And that was with De Bruyne and Haaland on the bench. Then KDB and Haaland comes back against Palace and they both score. So you kind of have options there. They're in the FA Cup still. That can be a slight disadvantage. Liverpool and Arsenal are out. They have, again, most likely a semi-final against Arsenal in the Champions League lurking. Of course, if either of them go out of the Champions League, that will be a big advantage to their league prospects, I think. I do think Arsenal will get past Bayern. I think City will get past Real Madrid. And it's possible that this doubleheader of them facing off against each other will just sap a lot of energy and focus away from them, and that they might drop the ball elsewhere, and that Liverpool just kind of creep up behind. I mean, if you're a Liverpool fan, that's something you'll be hoping for right now. These distractions in the form of the Cup and the Champions League, that is kind of the big thing for City. If you look at the league games in isolation, the kind of form they've been showing, I back them to win them all, honestly. Again, Tottenham are the unlikely kingmakers, and it is interesting to see when the Tottenham City game ends up being played. As far as I could tell now, it hasn't been decided yet. And City are another one who haven't been amazing against the other top teams. They didn't win any of their 4 games against Liverpool and Arsenal. They were held to a 3-3 draw at home by Spurs. From a Tottenham perspective, I worry about that City game because Tottenham always concede so much space in wide areas. I feel like that's something Guardiola will find a way to exploit. But Spurs did get a 3-3 draw, a very lucky one at the Etihad, but they managed to get a result. Anyway, I digress. For me, it comes down to this. I think Arsenal will drop points at some point because of the fixtures. I think Liverpool will drop points at some point because I don't quite trust them. It's a short version of it. And City, I mean, Luton, Brighton, Forest, Wolves, Fulham, West Ham. Luton and Forest should be easy, really, because of the sort of discrepancy in quality of this team and all this. Brighton and Fulham can be dangerous, but they're both well and truly on the beach. West Ham will possibly still be fighting for a European spot when they play City, but David Moyes' record against the big teams is pretty poor. And yeah, it would be a surprise to see them get anything. It is the Tottenham game. And when that is played is an interesting question. But it could be recency bias again, but just thinking of how easily Nottingham Forest were able to counter against Spurs and create stuff, how easily Fulham were able to play through them a couple of weeks ago. Maybe this thing about Spurs being kingmakers here, maybe that just ends up with Tottenham losing all of those games. I don't know. No, I have a very strong feeling that City will just win the rest of their games now. I think that's the territory we're into. And maybe that is, again, because I've seen them do it before. But honestly, I feel like because there's been so much talk about City not looking quite like themselves, we've almost not noticed that they're just winning all their games. Except when they play Arsenal and Liverpool. Aside from that, they've just been getting the points. And I think the other two will drop points, and I think City will win the rest, and that'll be enough. Now, that's not really a joyful prediction on my part. I think it would be very good for the Premier League if a team not named Manchester City won it at this point. If Klopp and Liverpool won it, it'd be a good story. It'd be nice because they're so fun to watch. If Arsenal do it, I mean, for me, being Spurs, I say this through gritted teeth, but I mean, they finished eighth two seasons in a row fairly recently, and then climbing from that into being a credible title challenger is incredibly impressive if they manage to do it with a pretty young team. I mean, you can hear me choking just saying it, but no, it would be a good story. It would be good for the league, I think. I just have a sneaking suspicion that City will find a way. And I can tell you, so do the bookmakers. I mean, let's check what the odds are on this thing now. I've spoken enough about it. Betson are offering a price of 2.50 on Manchester City to win the league right now. They do have City as narrow favourites. Arsenal are priced at 2.75. Liverpool now are priced at 3.25. So that is a big swing, given that, as I remember, Liverpool were actually the favourites ahead of the weekend. I'm a little bit tempted by 2.50 on City. I think that's what's going to happen. The price is maybe, yeah, no, it's tempting. I just think with City, yeah, it's 19 wins in the last 22. Right? 19 wins in the last 22 in all competitions. The three games they didn't win were against Liverpool and against Arsenal, and again, that sort of statistically implausible game against Chelsea. Against the normal teams, they've been just chugging away and getting the job done, and it is, I guess, all those other games other than Tottenham, I think they'll win. And I wish we knew when the Tottenham game will be played, if it's tight up against one of the other big games and if that can cause some complications. But I just fear that we're in this sort of situation where City has snapped into City mode now and are just winning all the things. What might be a more interesting bet, actually, more of a long shot, but Betson are offering a price of 6 on Manchester City to finish on over 90.5 points, so effectively on them winning the rest of their games. A 6 is the odds there. That is an implied probability. I looked this up. That implies a probability of 16.7% chance of that happening. I think there's more than a 16% chance of City winning the rest of their games from here on out, looking at who their fixtures are. Betson have put a price on Arsenal and Liverpool to win the rest of their games as well. They're both priced at 10. I mean, particularly if you're an Arsenal fan and you're a bit annoyed with me right now because they have won 10 in the last 11, to be fair to them, only dropping points against City. If you feel very, very strongly that I'm wrong, that Arsenal will go on and win the rest of their games, 10 times your stake with Betson might be worth a long shot there. I just think they have those three games against wildly inconsistent and weird United, Chelsea, and Tottenham teams. I feel like something will go wrong for them in one of them. I'm not sure which one. Wouldn't want to bet on that. But anyway, that's where I'm at with my thinking. What a season, anyway. What a season. How so much fun. It's the tightest three-way since... Well, let's not finish that sentence. I'll get in trouble. We'll leave those kind of jokes for the next time Peter is on. Wholesome Peter, with his surprisingly dirty mind. And always, I never see it coming when he goes blue, but he does it more often than you'd expect. Anyway, the Lars Resort is officially back from hiatus. back from his journeys and Easter shenanigans. More episodes to come. Thank you very much for keeping me company. Let's have a great couple of months of Premier League football as this wonderful season culminates in huge excitement. And may the best team win is such a naff thing to say, isn't it? May the best team win. Which team do I actually want to see win? I mean, it all kind of works for me, doesn't it? Because I like the Klopp winning story. That'd be fun. For someone who just wrote a book on Erling Haaland, it's him scoring a few goals and City lifting a trophy. I guess that kind of suits me as well. But of course, we have a Norwegian captain of Arsenal. Yeah. So all of them, you know, there's stuff for me to enjoy. Should be fun. Should be a great spring. I hope you'll spend some of it with me. Bye.